17 come together.
Yeah, yeah. So today we're reading from the Gloria Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 8, Chapter 9, entitled The Lord Incarnates as Mohini Murti. And we'll start with verse 16. That's right. Just breathe after me. Pran.
Pran.
Mukeshu pavishteshu.
Mukeshu pavishteshu.
Pran mukeshu pavishteshu.
Pran mukeshu pavishteshu.
Sureshu.
Sureshu.
Ditijeshu.
Ditijeshu.
Cha.
Cha.
Sureshu ditijeshu cha.
Sureshu ditijeshu cha.
Dupamodita.
Dupamodita.
Shalayam.
Shalayam.
Dupamodita shalayam.
Dupamodita shalayam.
Jushtayam.
Jushtayam.
Malya.
Malya.
Dipikai.
Dipikai.
Jushtayam malya dipikai.
Jushtayam malya dipikai.
Pran mukheshu pavishteshu.
Pran mukheshu pavishteshu.
Sureshu dichijeshu cha.
Sureshu dichijeshu cha.
Dupamodita shalayam.
Dupamodita shalayam.
Jushtayam malya dipikai.
Jushtayam malya dipikai.
Pran mukeshu pavishteshu.
Pran mukeshu pavishteshu.
Sureshu ditijeshu cha.
Sureshu ditijeshu cha.
Dupamodita shalayam.
Dupamodita shalayam.
Jushtayam malya dipikahai.
Jushtayam malya dipikahai.
Others.
Pran mukeshu pavishteshu.
Pran mukeshu pavishteshu.
Sureshu ditijeshu cha.
Sureshu ditijeshu cha.
Dupamodita shalayam.
Dupamodita shalayam. Jushtayam malya dipikai.
Pran mukeshu pavishteshu.
Pran mukeshu pavishteshu.
Sureshu ditijeshu cha.
Sureshu ditijeshu cha.
Dupamodita shalayam. Jushtayam malya dipikai.
By meditating on the object of the senses. Second chapter.
Meditating
on the object of the senses. I think it's like around 250. This is one paper. I'll look for it. Please repeat after me. Prak mukeshu.
Prak mukeshu.
Facing east.
Facing east.
Upavishteshu.
Upavishteshu.
We're sitting on their respective seats.
Sitting on their respective seats.
Sureshu.
Sureshu.
All the demigods.
Ditijeshu.
The demons.
Cha.
Also. Dupa amodita shalayam. In the arena, which is full of smoke,
of incense.
Jushtayam.
Fully decorated.
Malya dipikai. with flower garlands and lamps. That was the first part of the verse. I'll just read the translation of both verses. Translation by Srila Prabhupada. O King, as the demigods and demons sat facing east in an arena fully decorated with flower garlands and lamps and fragrant with the smoke of incense, that woman, dressed in a most beautiful sari, her ankle bells tinkling, entered the arena, walking very slowly because of her big, low hips. Her eyes were restless due to youthful pride. Her breasts were like water jugs. Her thighs resembled the trunks of elephants, and she carried a water pot in her hand. Text 18. Her attractive nose and cheeks and her ears, adorned with golden earrings, made her face very beautiful. As she moved, her sari's border on her breasts moved slightly aside. When the demigods and demons saw these beautiful features of Mohini Murthy, who was glancing at them and slightly smiling, they were all completely enchanted. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Srila Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur remarks here that Mohini Murthy is the Supreme Personality of Godhead in a feminine form, and that the Goddess of Fortune is her associate. So that'd be like Lakshmi Mohini Murthy on the altar. That would be an interesting. Okay. Is her associate. This form assumed by the personality of Godhead challenged the Goddess of Fortune. The Goddess of Fortune is beautiful, but if the Lord accepts the form of a woman, He surpasses the Goddess of Fortune in beauty. It is not that the Goddess of Fortune, being a female, is the most beautiful. The Lord is so beautiful that He can excel any beautiful goddess of fortune by assuming a female form. What we notice while Bhagavatam was reading through this section is how everybody, demons and demigods, were immediately attracted to Mohini Murthy, how she was just completely enchanted them. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the third canto, it describes the Tanmatras. Tanmatras is a trio of, you can say, configuration of how the material energy is created. With each element, there is a sense and a sense object. So from, first with ether. With ether, the associated sense is the ear, and the object of the sense of the ear is the sound, right? So if there's ether, that means there's an ear, and then there's sound. Then comes, from ether comes air. And with air, we feel this, there's the sense of the skin and the sense of touch, right? Then we can tell if there's any air, if it brushes against our skin. And then we feel the sensation of touch. Then, from air comes fire. And with the associated senses, the eye and form. And then from fire comes water. The associated senses, tongue and taste. So that is, there's no water, You can't taste anything. That's why I said, you know, if you want to insult something, you say it's dry. That means it has no taste. No water. If your tongue is dry, you can't taste anything. There's no taste. There's no juice. They say it's not juicy. It's not. There's no ras. It has to be moist. If something is moist, you can taste it. And then from water comes earth. And with earth, the sense is the nose, and then the object is smell, gandha. So, and Krishna has made the whole arrangement. Of course, we have spiritual senses, we have material senses. So Krishna made the arrangement in such a way that as soon as the senses, there's going to be the sense object. So as soon as the sense is in contact with the sense object, there's an immediate attraction. The mind determines whether it's good or not. Right? That's the whole purpose of the mind is to determine, you know, the data comes in to this via the senses to the mind, and then the mind determines whether it's good or not. Does it sound good? Like, here's one, he'll, you know, as Prabhu will tell us, if our voice is not right, he'll make the sound, he'll make a funny face, right? We'll get the thumbs down. We'll get the it doesn't suit his ear. We get it. So immediately, that's what the mind does. Does it sound good or does it sound bad? Does it feel good or feel bad? Do some things feel good? You know, a nice silk, you know, silk feels very soft, or some fur, you know, some feather. Yeah, but, you know, you slide across the street and gravel doesn't feel very good on your skin, right? You lose some, you've all as kids skinned our knees, right? That didn't feel so great. Or going back to sound, what's one of the worst sounds you can hear is when somebody scratches their fingers across a blackboard. And that's like, you know, everybody's teeth, they get all, it's a horrible sound. You know, and then, of course, sight. So this is the whole. This whole part here is about as soon as that form. It seems to be the most powerful one is the form. As soon as the form of the opposite sex is there, person may have been totally peaceful, but if that form is attractive, the person becomes very attractive. You know, they become agitated, highly agitated. Krishna's putting some mystic potency in this certain curvature. You know, the twist, the way the nose is this way and that, or the like it's described here, how her hips were low and wide. And of course, it works both ways. Women are also attracted to men to women. It's like it would describe it after the Swayamvara ceremony of Draupadi. When she came to the home of the Pandavas, the five Pandavas, they were sitting looking at her. And she was the same thing. She was totally taking them in with her eyes. She was drinking in the beauty of the Pandavas with her eyes. Not that only the men are interested in the beauty of the woman, the women are also interested in the beauty of the men. So it's somehow Krishna's put a totally mystic potency. As soon as the form is there, boom, we're totally attracted. So now, of course, there's spiritual senses and material senses. If we become attracted to the material senses, to the sense objects, then there's a problem. Krishna explained it very nicely in the Gita, second chapter. What does he say here? While contemplating the objects of the senses, a person develops attachment for them, and from such attachment, what develops?
Lust
develops. And from lust, anger arises. So lust is not love. We want to develop, because it's for something material, lust develops. So that lust is simply a transformation of our love for Krishna. Right? We had originally we had love for Krishna, but Krishna's spiritual. We are spiritual. The spiritual senses had a love for Krishna. But once we're entrapped in the material body, then we're thinking that we're going to be the enjoyer. And we, you know, when we see a material object, our senses become attached and we develop lust. Lust is we want to control, dominate, exploit, enjoy. So from such attachment, lust develops, and from lust, anger arises. Anger arises because we become frustrated. From anger, complete delusion arises, and from delusion, bewilderment of memory. We become bewildered, but what is the goal of life? When memory is bewildered, intelligence is lost, and when intelligence is lost, one falls down again into the material pool. So this is what happens when our material senses contemplate the material sense objects. We eventually just get totally entangled and entrapped in Maya. But what happens if we develop our spiritual senses and become attracted to Krishna? Right? The whole process of bhakti yoga is the uncovering. What is the first verse of the Shikshashtaka? Cheta Darpana Marjana. We're cleaning the mirror of the mind. Taking away all this material covering. We actually have a spiritual mind. We have spiritual senses. And that means that there are also spiritual sense objects. It's not impersonal. We have a spiritual mind, we have spiritual senses, spiritual intelligence, and spiritual sense objects. So that spiritual sense object is Krishna. That's why it's described in the Shastra that simply by seeing Krishna it is the perfection of our vision. Hearing the sound is perfection of our ears. Right? So by becoming attached, by meditating on Krishna, then the opposite happens. That by meditating on the object of the senses, we become lust develops and we fall into the material pool. By meditating on the spiritual object, then prema develops. It's a gradual process because we've been used to looking other way. I was reading in the Vedanta Sutra commentary about the Vidyabhushan, and he describes that he quotes one verse from the Varaha Purana, which describes that during Jagrati, which is waking consciousness, that the soul is focused in the eyes. And in dreaming state, it's in the throat, and in Susupti, it's in the heart. The point being is that when we're awake, we're focused looking outward. We're looking outward, trying to find some object for our gratification. Sense that we're looking, how are we going to enjoy? We're looking outside. Looking outside of ourselves for some sense gratification. Whereas actually in deep sleep the soul is in the heart. Because that is where it's in the dhara, which is the Brahman, and actually the soul is the only time the vast majority of people are in contact with God is during deep sleep, because during deep sleep we're actually in contact with Krishna, because that's how we get rejuvenated. Described in the Shastra, we become rejuvenated in deep sleep because during our waking hours we're in contact with the dead material world. So it's like if you were to take a bottle of hot water and stick it into Lake Ontario, after a very short period of time it would become cold, right? So you have to take it back out and you put it into a pot of hot water, it gets hot again. So we are naturally spiritual, but we're stuck in the material world. We become dead. So that's why we become tired. And we become revitalized when we go and we enter back into God. That's what happens in our deep sleep. That's why we need to sleep. Described in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad and also in the Chandogya Upanishad. So, by becoming attached to Krishna, then we will, the whole process of chanting the holy name, of seeing the beautiful form of the deity, smelling the incense. First of all, we have to hear the kirtan. I don't know about feeling. I guess we see the form of the deity. We taste the prasadam. We smell the incense. Smell the attar. Prabhu's always going on giving us the you smell the attar, the oils which are offered to the deities. Then by this way, by purifying our senses, then we will enter into, we will attain the pure love of God. Another thing we notice here is that about Mohini Murthy, is that though she is the Supreme Personality of God, she's not addressed as Prabhu. She's still addressed in the feminine form. Demons are by... what time is it, Prabhu?
8:04.
I'll read a couple more verses and we can have some little discussion if anybody has anything to say. Demons are by nature crooked like snakes. Therefore, to distribute a share of the nectar to them was not at all feasible, since this would be as dangerous as supplying milk to a snake. Considering this, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who never falls down, did not deliver a share of nectar to the demons. It is said, Sarpa krura kala kruraha, sarpa krurarataha kalaha. The snake is very crooked and envious, and so also is a person like a demon. Mantroshadi vashaha sarpa kala kena nirvaryate. One can bring a snake under control with mantras, herbs and drugs. But an envious and crooked person cannot be brought under control by any means. Considering this logic, the Supreme Personality of Godhead thought it unwise to distribute nectar to the demons. Supreme Personality of Godhead as Mohini Murthy, the Master of the Universe, arranged separate lines of sitting places and seated the demigods and demons according to their positions. Now we notice that he didn't serve out in buffet style. Traditionally, Srila Prabhupada taught us the way, this is the traditional Vedic way. You sit down on the floor in separate lines, sitting places, and prasadam is served. Srila Prabhupada himself, he used to serve out. He used to serve out personally on the floor, not standing in buffet. Not sitting at a table. See, Mohini Murthy, this is the standard is right here. Not that we have to follow. We're following in the footsteps. We have to approach Krishna on his terms. Not that he has to fulfill us, our desires on our terms. What do you say? You agree?
You ain't.
You're going to disagree with Mohini Murthy?
Yeah.
Taking the container of nectar in her hands, she first approached the demons, satisfied them with sweet words, and thus cheated them of their share of the nectar. Then she administered the nectar to the demigods, who were sitting at a distant place, to make them free from invalidity, old age, and death. Mohini Murthy, the Personality of Godhead, gave the demigods seats at a distance. Then she approached the demons and spoke with them very graciously, so that they thought themselves very fortunate to talk with her. Now, one thing is, one might think that, they saw Krishna. They spoke with Mohini Murthy, then they're purified, right? They'll go back to Godhead. Some people might say like that, isn't it? They say that because, they saw Krishna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra just by seeing him. But is that just by seeing Krishna, is that good enough? What does Krishna say in Bhagavad Gita? Sarva daman parityagya mam ekam sharanam vraja ahang tong sarva papyabhyo moksha yashami masuchaha. He says, does he say, give up all types of religion? They say, just see me and I will protect you? Or does he say, just surrender to me? They saw, the demons saw Mohini Murthy, they spoke with her, but did they surrender to her? Well, they actually, in one sense they did. Because they were so captivated by her that they agreed with him, but they didn't surrender. They didn't become the servant. They didn't like in the battlefield of Kurukshetra, they didn't surrender to Krishna to become his servant. They saw Krishna. Seeing is not enough. It may be helpful, maybe get some purification, maybe there. But we have to surrender, not simply see. We have to surrender our life, not simply speak with Krishna. And that's obviously it's good. But so many demons saw Krishna and they didn't surrender. How many times on the battlefield, you know, when Krishna came on sitting on Garuda, and the demons are fighting with him, they're not surrendering. They have to surrender when they fall down dead on the battlefield. But but then again, they just get the Sayuja Mukti. They don't get the true devotion. Then she approached the demons and spoke with them very graciously, so that they thought themselves very fortunate to talk with her. Well, actually they were. Since Mohini Murti had seated demigods at a distant place, the demons thought that the demigods would get only a little of the nectar, and that Mohini Murti was so pleased with the demons that she would give the demons all the nectar. The words Vanchayan Upasancharai indicate that the Lord's whole policy was to cheat the demons simply by speaking sweet words. The Lord's intention was to distribute the nectar only to the demigods. So here we see that Lord Krishna is the personification of diplomacy. Total diplomacy. Whether they say a diplomat is somebody who can tell you to go to hell and you look forward to the trip. they say it in such a diplomatic way, they tell you to go to hell and you look forward to going. That's an expert diplomat. So Krishna was like that. He was so expert in his diplomacy with the demons that he totally cheated them, and they enjoyed it. O King, since the demons had promised to accept whatever the woman did, whether just or unjust, now to keep this promise, to show their equilibrium, and to save themselves from fighting with a woman, they remained silent. So I mean, even the demons had some sort of chivalry there. They didn't want to fight with her. The demons, well, now we see why. The demons had developed affection for Mohini Murti and a kind of faith in her, and were afraid of disturbing their relationship. In a previous purport, Srila Prabhupada explained it, just like Lord Buddha cheated the atheist so that they would put a faith in him, in Lord Buddha, in the same way, so that this must have elevated the asuras, because they developed affection for the Supreme Personality of Godhead in this form, and they developed some sort of faith. And therefore they showed respect and honor to her words and did not say anything that might disturb their friendship with her. The demons were so captivated by the tricks and friendly words of Mohini Murti that although the demigods were served first, the demons were pacified merely by sweet words. The Lord said to the demons, "The demigods are very miserly and are excessively anxious to take the nectar first. So let them have it first. Since you are not like them, you can wait a little longer. You are all heroes and are so pleased with me, it is better for you to wait until after the demigods drink."
Are you reading the translation or the purport?
That was the purport.
Can you tell us? Because I don't know if that translation.
Oh, that was... No, that's a quote. The Lord said to the demons. This is a quote in the purport. Translation 24. Rahu, the demon who causes eclipses of the sun and moon, covered himself with the dress of a demigod and thus entered the assembly of the demigods and drank nectar without being detected by anyone, even by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The moon and the sun, however, because of permanent animosity toward Rahu, understood the situation. Thus, Rahu was detected. Purport. The Supreme Personality of Godhead, Mohini Murti, was able to bewilder all the demons. But Rahu was so clever that he was not bewildered. That's because Rahu is, one of the things about Rahu, from an astrological perspective, is that Rahu signifies things like false logic, you know, kutarka, bewildering people. So Rahu is an expert at bewildering, of illusioning. So he could tell a good trick when it was happening. He could tell, like somebody who gives good advice can appreciate good advice. So Rahu is expert at false logic and word jugglery. So he could, he represents those type of things. So when he could understood a good spiel when he heard it. So he was not bewildered, because he goes around bewildering people the same way. So Rahu could understand Mohini Murti was cheating the demigods, the demons, and therefore he changed his dress, disguised himself as a demigod, and sat down in the assembly of the demigods. Here one may ask why the Supreme Personality of Godhead could not detect Rahu. The reason is that the Lord wanted to show the effects of drinking nectar. This will be revealed in the following verses. The moon and sun, however, were always alert in regard to Rahu. Thus, when Rahu entered the assembly of the demigods, the moon and sun immediately detected him, and then the Supreme Personality of Godhead also became aware of him. So an interesting point here, that there was one essay that Bhakti Siddhanta wrote in the, I guess it was the Harmonist or one of those magazines, you know, from the 1920s, where he describes about how Maya, just like it's described that we're at war, you know, we're at war with Maya, so that sometimes, you know, Maya, just like in any type of war, you send in agents to the opposing side, you know, to undermine, to infiltrate. He was describing how Maya sends people to pose as devotees. They're posing, they can be very skillful in their speech. He gives a whole list of symptoms, how they can be very charismatic, they speak very nicely, and they fool everybody, posing as devotees. And only the most advanced and even advanced devotees, you know, not just like, you know, some rookies would become fooled by them, even, you know, others would, only the most pure devotees could detect them, and they would stay away. So they were posing as devotees, that whole little essay he wrote about that. So here we see Rahu, not the first time, somebody, he's posing as a devotee and got away with it until they got caught. He drank the nectar. So we should be cautious of those who also pose as devotees. Bhaktivinoda Thakur's disappearance day is coming up. Is it tomorrow? Disappearance or appearance? Disappearance, yeah. So it's the 100th anniversary of his disappearance. He disappeared in 1914. Then came the massive war that took place after that. So he wrote that article, you know. He's the one who said, yeah, just said somebody is a Kali Chela. Just because he's wearing tilak and kanti mala and the dhoti, that doesn't mean that they're just pretending to be devotees. So this is something we have to be very vigilant. Very vigilant. We hear of guru, sadhu, and shastra. But there's also, you know, sampradaya, shastra, and siddhanta. Somebody's coming in to write sampradaya, you know, but are they reading the, you know, are they in the sampradaya? Are they reading the proper shastra? And if they're reading the shastra, do they come to the correct conclusion? Is their siddhanta correct? Some people, they may have the right sampradaya, they have the right shot, but then they come to the, they generate their own conclusions. You know, they therefore misleading. That goes on quite a bit, actually. So I'll leave it here. If we could have any, what time is it, please? Okay. Any discussion, Mataji?
You're talking about the developing our spiritual senses.
Yes.
Can you explain that in relation to the one verse in Brahma Samhita? Yadbhava bhavita dhyamana jasya kaiva sampraptya upanayana sanyana dusha. You know how like they develop their, like they have in the spiritual world, the souls, they have their forms, they have their asanas, they have their conveniences, and they serve the Supreme Lord in that way.
Okay, repeat the translation.
How they have, they, by reciting the Vedic hymns, they realize their forms and they have their conveniences and asanas in the spiritual world. Like they develop that.
Yeah.
They come to that point. Can you?
Well, at our point, we're asleep.
Yeah.
We're all asleep. And the process of awakening, we have to first come to our consciousness. We have to come to develop our consciousness. So that comes by the chanting of the holy name. Because we're in the Bhagavad Sampradaya, so our main process is chanting of the holy name. We also, the secondary practice is Pancharatrika Vidhi, which is the deity worship. But our main is the chanting of the holy name. That will wake us up. Right? And then, just see when, what happens when we wake. Well, first of all, we have to understand what happens when we sleep. It's from a material perspective, because what happens in the material world is a reflection, in many ways, of what happens in the spiritual world. So as described in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, when we, the consciousness is all pervading through the body. Even though the Atma is only 1/10,000th the size of the tip of the hair, yet if you stub your toe, you feel it, right? You know, if you're walking, even though the soul is situated in the heart, you're aware of everything that goes on in your body, because it pervades through the blood, through the prana, through all your body. You're aware of all your senses, the mind, and everything. When you go to sleep, the consciousness, the soul enters into Brahman, and all the consciousness recedes into the heart. Like that. So, and then when we wake up again, it pervades again through the body. So, basically, we're spiritually asleep. From a spiritual perspective, we're asleep. That's why Lord Chaitanya explains, Jeev Jago, Jeev Jago, Gaura Chandra Bodhidev. And we are sleeping in the lap of the witch called Maya. So we have to wake up from that. And when we wake up, then, so when you wake up, what happens when you first wake up, then you are aware of your surroundings, you see the colors, you become aware of all the sense objects, your senses become active again, right? When they had previously been in hibernation, because they were suspended. So that's what we're like. We're like in the suspended mode. When we wake up, then these things, you don't instantly wake up. It's a gradual process. You begin hearing some sound, and then it becomes more, and then you realize it's your alarm clock, right? Or it's the conch shell. Oh, I slept in. It's time to go. It's Mangal Arti, and my alarm didn't go off, right? Hare Krishna. Is that? But at first, it doesn't sound like a blaring sound. It's like first, it's very small, and then it gets bigger, and then you wake up like that. But can you repeat what you, because the thing is, there's also somewhat of an echo effect in here, and I can't quite make out what you were saying about the translation from that.
Well, you were talking about awakening our spiritual senses.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was asking you to explain that in relation to that verse from Brahma Samhita.
And what is that? No, that's the part I'm asking about. What does it say in that verse in the Brahma Samhita?
Translation.
Okay, give me
But like it says, about the souls in the spiritual world, they retain their forms. You know, they're liberated, so they're awake, and they've attained their spiritual forms, and they have the paraphernalia, and they have their asanas, and they have...
Oh, I mean their swarupa, their siddha swarupa.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, so the soul, the Atma, has its... we have a spiritual form. We have senses, everything. But we are covered over. Totally covered with... you could say, like in a... the example would be in like in a virtual reality machine. Like if you have... I think I described it in my other previous class. I was at the annual convention for the American Psychiatric Association 2005. And they were demonstrating different virtual reality machines that they were created to help people with psychiatric problems. You put the helmet on and you think you're in another world. It was the one I was demonstrated was some for people who are afraid of flying. So you sit in this chair, the chair is on a little platform, you sit in the chair and you put this helmet on and you look inside and you're inside an airplane. So wherever you look, you're inside the airplane. And then they press the button and then the chair starts to vibrate and you think you're taking off. And inside the plane, you see everything is moving. Right? And that's 2005. That's 10 years ago. Things have significantly... advanced since then. I saw one demonstration of Sony Xbox where it was a BBC. The guy was reviewing it. So he put the helmet on and inside it's a surround camera and he's describing he's underwater. He's seeing all these fish and things like that and he's talking, he's describing and all of a sudden he starts screaming, he's in terror because he's being attacked by a shark. He thinks it's real. So his senses, so he has his own senses, but they're being covered with this, over his eyes is a screen. And then he puts earplugs in. You see these, people all the time, you're walking around with their earbuds. I was just reading about this one young woman. She was brutally raped and murdered. Why did it take place? She was in her own world. She was listening to her iPod up loud at 2 o'clock in the morning. She didn't hear the guy approach. She was in her own world. Right? Because her senses were covered. She covered her sense of hearing with these things. So our senses, our spiritual senses, have been covered over. Literally, a layer has been put over them. A material layer of material senses. And so that's what gets uncovered, taken off. When that gets pulled off, then what's left over is our spiritual senses, our spiritual mind, our spiritual intelligence.
So when it's covered, it's just quiet, like...
No. Oh, when it's covered?
Yeah.
No, then we seek after material objects. See, that's the whole thing with the tanmatras. There's the element, the sense that goes with it, and then the sense object. So with ether, the sense is the ear. So then the ear wants to hear sound. Then with the air comes the skin, sense of touch. It wants to feel things. That's why if the vata in Ayurveda, if vata is disturbed, then that's why people feel a lot of pain in their body. Arthritis, the different types of pain is associated with vata, the sensation. And then with fire comes the eye. And with the eye is the form. Everybody wants to see beautiful forms. Like these demons. They were totally captivated by the beautiful form of Mohini Murti. The way her... Just seeing that her sari moves a little bit, her breasts, and they were like all excited, you know. Or there's another one. Was it when Lord Shiva wants to see Mohini Murti, and I think when she's playing with a ball... She's playing with a ball and she's moving and the sari moves and then Shiva comes completely crazy. It was completely crazy chasing after her. So the the senses become attracted that way. Krishna's made it such a mystically. Even a person becomes agitated. I mean, I don't know sure if I answered your question. Okay. As Bhakti, Bhakti Vidyabhushan explains in the last portion of the Vedanta Sutra, the soul, when it's liberated, can manifest a form or not manifest a form. It can manifest it whatever different forms it wants to. But it prefers it, but it wants to manifest a form which is pleasing to Krishna. And all the different, because that's our original nature. We're covered. Just like when you go into the, Srila Prabhupada explained it in one conversation with Hari Kesh. He was describing about how when they have sex, they don't want to have covered pleasure. And he's trying to explain, he's trying to think of the word, what it meant. He meant condom. Because people don't want to use, so Hari Kesh said prophylactics, you know. So that nobody wants to have covered pleasure. They want uncovered pleasure. So it goes into this whole, we're covered with the body. We have to remove this material covering, then we can have real pleasure. That's uncovered pleasure. Because the soul has been, you know, imagine if you had to wear a wetsuit. Or you don't really feel everything the same. So we have to remove the body. Ultimately, the soul has two desires: security and pleasure. We want security and we want pleasure. Anandamaya Basad, it is a pleasure seeking entity. Pain avoiding, pleasure seeking. So that ultimately we want to join with Krishna. That's the ultimate, we want to join with that desire, so it gets manifested in the material world as sex. Wanting to join, we are attracted always, that's why it happens. That desire for union. That's the ultimate, as one person described in one newspaper article, for most people this is going to be as close as they get to any type of, because you merge with somebody else type of idea, you know, that you lose your sense of. And that's a very limiting concept, because the problem is that there's no souls getting together, because there's a body in between. The material body is separating. It's covering the soul. So that's why it becomes very frustrating. That no matter how much a person may endeavor for sexual gratification, the soul is never satisfied, because it's a function of the body, of the material body, not of the soul. But it's the soul's desire to become unified, but not lose its identity.
Yes, the way Nandini asked the question got me thinking, in the way you're explaining about the senses, the spiritual senses, where we have spiritual mind, spiritual senses. So I just, maybe if you could see if I understand, or maybe explain it. Is it that when the spirit soul is embodied, so the spirit spiritual consciousness is now conditioned and it's filtered through the material consciousness, the material conception, is it that the spiritual senses are actually turned off?
No, they're covered. Covered. Okay, just like in the example I gave you. See, where's the Bhagavad Gita here? It's very nicely explained in 6th chapter, verse 20 to 23. In the stage of perfection called trance or samadhi, one's mind is constantly restrained from material mental activities by a practice of yoga. This perfection is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind, and to relish and rejoice in the self. In that joyous state, one is situated in boundless, transcendental happiness, realized through transcendental senses. Established thus, one never departs from the truth, and upon gaining this, he thinks there is no greater gain. being situated in such a position, one is never shaken even in the midst of greatest difficulty. This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. So returning to the analogy, or that example of the guy who is demonstrating the Sony Xbox. He's got, he is a person, and then he's put this thing over his head where now his senses, it doesn't see the world, he's seeing this image projected by the Sony Xbox. And now he thinks he's in underwater. He thinks he's in another world, he's underwater, and everything is happy, little fishes, but all of a sudden, a shark attacks him, and he started shouting. He didn't expect, he didn't know that was going to happen. He was the first time he had experienced it. So, because he's meditating, he thinks it's, to him, imagine that, that was only going on for a few minutes. Imagine if you were watching it for hours, for days. What if you were born with that on your head?
Yeah.
Birth after birth. I read about one guy in China. He died, he was in his early 20s, he died after 55 hours of continuous playing in one of these massive multiple user games where you're in one of these like World of Warlock or all these different kinds of, there's all kinds of them, he died of heart failure because he only for 55 hours continuous playing stopped only to go to the toilet. He died of a heart failure because he had not the first time, he had done it many, many times. He lost his job, lost his wife, totally immersed in that world. And these virtual realities. But that's just seeing it on the computer screen. What happens when the screen is glued to your eyes?
Exactly.
And the speakers, are in earbuds in your ear. That's what it blocks out all other sounds. You don't see anything else. And if, they can make it even more sophisticated when you put sensors, they're going to do it. They put sensors on your arms and you can see, when you move your hand, you see things happening. And that the virtual, that the American Academy, the American Psychiatric Association, they wanted to have virtual realities where you can even smell things because they wanted to have soldiers who had been in Iraq, who had been in these big Humvees where they could smell the sweat, they could smell the smell of Iraqi cooking, the smell of burning cordite and diesel and explosives, so that when they have these, it's very sophisticated now. It'll become more and more sophisticated. But Krishna has already done it. We're born in this virtual reality. We think this is real. Maya is a virtual reality, and Krishna is the programmer. I have a Mac, and on my Mac I have a program called Parallels, which is a virtual machine. And I run Windows programs in there. My Windows programs don't know that it's on a Mac. He thinks that Windows program thinks it's on a Mac. It's on a Windows machine, but it's totally on a Mac. It doesn't know. And I can clone it onto some other machine and it won't know. It just thinks it's running in Windows. It actually runs better on the Mac than it does on a PC. But the point is that we can't tell. We think it's real. That the person is, just for a few minutes, he was totally enveloped because he couldn't see the outside world. He just sees, it's the when the television screen is glued to your eye, you're not going to see something else. At least if the television screen is in there, you can look around, you can see something, but when it's literally glued to your eyes and the speakers are stuck in your ears and you can't hear any external sounds and you have, artificial skin on top of your skin and you feel, then you're going to get pretty bewildered. And it's happened from birth and for millions of births. That's Krishna's virtual reality machine. But that's the major plot point of that movie, The Matrix. Anybody seen the movie, The Matrix?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's one of the major plot devices, was that they're exposing the virtual reality by taking the red pill. The red pill. Because the guys who made that movie, the Warkarskis, they read the Bhagavad Gita. Their parents were atheists. And to be, you know, a good rebellious American teenager, they read the Bhagavad Gita. They live in Chicago. Some of the book, you may have distributed the book to them, you know, because it was revealed. They had read the Bhagavad Gita and the Ramayana as, you know, as in their rebellion against their parents. They were. So, this is the red pill. This will remove the illusion of, you know, of that we're not these bodies. We are not these material senses. That's right. And it's by understanding this, it's like, you know, that if that guy, you know, the shark is attacking him, right? So if he takes off that helmet, you know, then puts it over there, the shark is still attacking in the helmet.
Yeah.
But he's not affected because he's not. So it's the karma, all the things which we're experiencing is not happening to the soul. It's happening to the gross and subtle body. It's happening in the virtual reality. So if we don't identify, if we take off the helmet, then it's not bothering us. That's why Krishna says here, establish thus, I mean, we take the helmet off, one never departs from the truth, and upon gaining this, he thinks there is no greater gain. Being situated in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of greatest difficulty. This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. Just to take that helmet off. That's what it means to be a Jivan Mukta. It's described in that in the third canto, I can't remember, was it 17th chapter or 27th chapter, where Kapil Dev is describing meditating upon the Lord in the heart. That is described that, he describes that as the soul, the God-intoxicated soul, just as a intoxicated man, you must have seen some winos in the street, an intoxicated man who's not aware of whether or not they're wearing clothing, in a similar way, a God-intoxicated person is not aware of whether or not they are wearing a body. And in such a condition, the Lord has to come and take control of the body until the destined activities of that body are completed. You know, the co-pilot had to grab the wheel because the soul is not even, if you're not even aware that you're driving your machine anymore, then Krishna has to take control until the destined activities. That's the purport where Prabhupada explains how the fan, once you turn the switch off the fan doesn't come to a screeching halt. It just continues going. As long as you don't turn it back on, as the momentum slows down, that means when the prarabdha karma is worn off, then that's it. That's it. So the prarabdha karma, the proof of your prarabdha karma, just go look in the mirror and you will see your prarabdha karma. It's there. But, you know, it could take one lifetime, it could take 10,000 lifetimes. What does it matter? If you're not aware of whether or not you have a body, it doesn't matter how long your body will last, because Krishna's driving it for you. But that requires that we realize it's one thing to know it theoretically; it's another thing to realize that. Any other questions? Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.